Broadcasting live from the Hyundai Studios, presented by your local Hyundai dealers. This is Chicago's number one and most listened to sports station. 670 The Score is Chicago Sports. Chicago Sports is The Score. WSCR and HD Chicago. WBMX HD2 Chicago. And Odyssey Station. The Score!
High in the air to right center. Robert didn't make the catch. He reached out, had it tick off his glove, never got the feet set, and it's 7-2.
That's an E8. We'll watch it again. Luis is supposed to make this catch, he just doesn't. And Adam Engel could have made the catch, but he defers to a center fielder, and then the ball falls.
Welcome back in on 670 The Score. It's Spiegs here with you. Matt Spiegel with you on Hit and Run. Jim Callis coming up at around 10:20 from MLB Pipeline. Ron Coomer next hour. Chris Kampka next hour. You guys, all morning long, hope you are well on a beautiful, flat-out glorious July 10th Sunday morning. And that, a lowlight from the Friday White Sox game. We talked at 9 o'clock, and will again a little bit later, about Johnny Cueto and the excellence of yesterday's game, especially Cueto. But as we're looking overall at the state of things, as a team under three games under 500, at this point in the year, with where they were supposed to be, we have to acknowledge some of the general ugliness, salute, that abounds with that team when they play games. And that Friday loss was ugly. Luis Robert drops that fly ball in the eighth, leads to an extra Tigers run that matters in the end, because the tying run came up to the plate a couple of times, but they could not get it done. With the White Sox, a couple of long fly balls there in the eighth and ninth that almost got there, but did not. And Lucas Giolito being allowed to stay out there in the seventh as he struggled, I don't think Tony has a very good feel for that crucial moment these days when the starter is tiring, the starter is in the final throws, and you're wondering when to make that hook. He leans on the starting pitcher, does Tony, and then talks about how they deserved it, how that was their inning, those kind of things. This is Tony. Is this from Friday? Him saying that about Giolito in that seventh inning?
The process of watching Lucas and
seeing. Well, did he get the first two outs out?
Right.
Did he pitch a hell of a game?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So he gets a big, gives a base hit, tough walk on 3-2, and I make a decision that he's earned the right to get that last out. He got him out the first time, second time at home run. That's the process. He's the guy that I thought earned it right to get that out, and I was confident he would.
So that's Tony's MO. I didn't even know that cut existed. That's funny. Sean, good hands, good eye, good ear. That's him cutting off James Fegan of The Athletic as he's asking about that moment. Said, did he get the first two outs? Yeah, he did. He's earned it. This is Tony's MO, and it worked for a lot of years. It worked for decades. It's a Hall of Fame manager, but the game has changed. And this idea that a starter has earned the right to finish an inning, be it the seventh or the sixth, sometimes the fifth, that's just not the way it is anymore. You can bemoan the fact that it's not that way anymore. Is it better for baseball when the starting pitcher goes deeper and you identify him and feel that he is an emblem of the game and the win or the loss is dependent on how that starting pitcher does, you know, to a great extent? Is that better overall for the game? You could argue that, actually. But is that the way the game is played, built, managed, and generally managed now? No, it's not. Hell, even yesterday after Cueto, did you hear Tony like lamenting the win-loss record for Johnny Cueto? Oh, boy, you know, it's too bad. No, it's all right. Hey, come on. We live in a world where people win Cy Youngs with an under 500 record as a starting pitcher. It's not about that anymore. Oh, God, it's so frustrating. So sometimes Tony will lean on that out of stubbornness and a desire to show faith in his guys that worked for a long, long time, but it's just not the way the game is managed anymore. Anyway, the White Sox are in the midst of their stretch of 19 games against the division. Last week, we talked about it a lot with you guys, and the general consensus, again, salute, is that this stretch, okay, what do you got? Let's go. Game on. What do we got? We're six games into it now. What do you see? Okay, we all needed to see it, right? All right, here's your time. Here's your chance. Going against the division. What do you got? 2-4 after the win yesterday. 2-4 against the Twins and the Tigers. Lots more against Cleveland and Minnesota coming. Overall, they are 12-16 against this division this year. Oh, by the way, they're 18-25 at home. And 2-4 in these six games. 2-4. It's been ugly. It's the same kind of stuff we've been seeing. And there have been a couple of moments. The first win against the Twins, flashpoint opportunity came from behind five different times. Amazing. But this team doesn't get a fire lit by a flashpoint and all of a sudden play better or slam the hell out of the ball in a way that can mask the fact that they're not playing better. They just don't seem to do it. Here we go. All right. 13 more in this stretch of 19. Now we'll see it, right? Here we go. This stretch of 13 within the stretch of 19 that we've been talking about, this is the important stretch. 312-644-6767. Let's go around the league with some fun stuff and some interesting stuff that does relate to the moment. First of all, out in San Francisco, do you see what this guy did? You see what he's doing? And this is what he did yesterday to end the game for the San Francisco Giants.
The 0-2 pitch. Hey, struck him out, and the Giants win it. And going the distance is Rodon. He goes all the way on 112 pitches.
112 pitches for Carlos Rodon. A complete game. And that dude was great at the beginning of the year, and we watched and wondered whether it was going to continue. You know, remember all the times people would say, yeah, let's see where he is in July. Okay, middle of July. He's got the eighth best ERA in the National League. He's got a 2.70 ERA. He's thrown 100 innings, a whip of 1.06, so just over one base runner per inning, has made 17 starts. And Carlos Rodon has given up 74 hits in those 100 innings. And in terms of strikeouts, 124 for Rodon is second in the National League to Corbin Burns. He's been terrific.
He hit 99 in that pitch, too. So people worried about his dead arm. Doing just fine.
Yeah, dead arm has not shown itself. Rodon signed, I think it's a two-year deal with an opt-out, though. I think he has an opt-out at the end of this year. So Rodon could opt out again and hit free agency again after a second straight year of being forced to gamble on himself a little bit and pitching his butt off. What's interesting is that the San Francisco Giants are in a very similar spot to the White Sox, but worse because the Dodgers own their division. So the Giants have played poorly and are probably going to be sellers here at the trade deadline. So do they trade Carlos Rodon? I think that might be one of the two most attractive starting pitchers on the market. Him and Luis Castillo would be my two guys, depending on what you want and what you need. So, look, if I'm the Giants, Rodon probably going to opt out. I absolutely field some phone calls right now.
Both him and Jack Peterson probably moving at the deadline, right?
Yeah, probably.
Another move for Jack. It'll be like his 15 in three seasons.
Is that what it'll be?
Something like that.
It's remarkable. It's remarkable. Jack, a big part of the Braves push last year after having been on both, so many teams. So many unbelievable teams.
He's on the last two World Series winners somehow.
Yeah, yep. That works. Reminds me of Eric Hinsky, four consecutive World Series champions with four different teams. Eric Hinsky.
It's a good call there.
Don Baylor, before that, three consecutive World Series champions on three different teams. He did that, or at least went to the World Series, because it was Red Sox in 86, it was Twins in 87, and Oakland in 88 for Don Baylor. And then Hinsky with four. And he won them all. Absolutely crazy. Speaking of the Red Sox, Good stuff at Fenway last night between the Red Sox and the Yankees.
Verdugo to left field. This game is tied. Here comes Jeter Downs. The throw from Gallo. The Red Sox walk it off.
After the Yankees took the first couple at Fenway, it's the Red Sox there with Jeter. Jeter walking it off against the Yankees. Jeter Downs is the player. Yankees remain the best team in baseball by a wide margin at 61-24. They have six more wins than both the Dodgers and the Houston Astros. They have eight more wins than their city partners, the New York Mets, who also had a chance yesterday to finish their game in style.
Fifth. And Brandon hits one back to the mound. Bobbled for a moment by Scott. Throws it away. Here comes Nino, and the Mets win it. Oh, wow. The Marlins melting down the bottom of the 10th, and the Mets rally for two runs with two out to win it 5-4.
Man, that is Gary Cohen with an exciting call as the Mets walk off the Marlins, and the Mets will be a buyer at the deadline. I know they are in first place in that division, but Atlanta looms and is playing well. 2.5 games back.
How about Spencer Strider, man?
That dude is crazy. And how about Dansby Swanson, who frankly ought to be the starter for the National League at shortstop? Trey Turner is the starter, and Trey Turner's having a very nice year. But Dansby Swanson's having an unbelievable year. But he will make the team, that's for sure. And even the Phillies, who are 7-3 in their last 10, that whole division, man, Miami, Philadelphia, and Atlanta, all three of them are 7-3 in their last 10. And the Mets are ahead by 2.5, as I mentioned, over Atlanta. But they'll be a buyer. They need a bat at the deadline. Fun stuff around the league. Baseball keeps giving you every day all these matchups, interesting teams, interesting players. And with the All-Star game looming and the reserves getting mentioned tonight at 5:30 Eastern time, I'm thankful for the rest of the league because sometimes the locals can be a little tough to focus on. Let's go to Ryan on 670 The Score. Ryan, part of the Twitch MOB, is here with us on Hit and Run on a Sunday morning. What's up, man? How you doing?
Good. How are you, Spiegs?
I am good. Am I supposed to say where you're from? I just don't want to just say your last name. Where should I tell people you're from, Ryan? A car?
You know, actually, I'm parked meeting up with a good portion of the mob. We're going to caravan into Lot B.
Let's go! Today.
I know.
Lot
I know.
B.
I'm excited.
Everybody's caravanning in. Twitch mob, White Sox game, hangout, pregame, yes, tailgate, and you're caravanning. That's the way to do it, so then you can all park next to each other, huh?
I'll give you one guess where we're sitting, too.
Let's see. Scout seats. Congratulations. I picked up that tab, too, for all you guys. I got scout seats for all you guys.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I got the invite last night. Thank you. We did it all online. It was great. We're actually going to be in the 108.
It's a fusion of the Parkinson Spiegel Twitch mob and the 108, the From the 108 guys. That is freaking glorious. I hope you get a wonderful game. You get a beautiful day, right? It's supposed to be beautiful all day?
Got the best day for it.
Oh.
Got the best day for it, Spiegel.
Come on now. That's awesome. I wish I could join you. It's going to be a high of 79 and pure sun all day long. That is just phenomenal.
I know. Hopefully we can get one going later on in the season.
Yeah. I'll be in. Absolutely. Enjoy your day. Did you enjoy Johnny Cueto yesterday, Ryan? Because he's the goods.
I mean, I've been enjoying Johnny Cueto all year. What a beautiful revelation. And we're able to see his style of pitching in the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's go ahead.
Sorry about that. So I have two questions for you. I know that you're out on the White Sox winning the division, no matter what Shane says. But I wonder if you would trade Johnny Cueto and get a return, because there's no point in keeping him if they're going to lose the division and not make the playoffs? And two, do you think that Rick Hahn is thinking about that?
Well, I think you're going to have to wait and see where you are at the end of this month. And you've got the opportunity for this stretch, which we know is not going well so far. And thank you for the call, Ryan. Have an awesome day out there with our people. Please give warm hugs or just a jellyfish. Throw them on the ground and then jellyfish on top of them and tell them it's from me. Do that for me. If you're Rick Hahn or if you're me, you have to wait until the end of the month, because as much as I am in a go ahead and show me mode for the White Sox, or I just don't believe that you're going to do it until you show it to me, you've got an opportunity here still, and you can't give up Cueto, who's been your most reliable starter. If you get to August 1st and you're even further out than you are now, and remember that in the division, because Minnesota and Cleveland both had lost on Friday. Minnesota lost again yesterday. Cleveland, though, with a win. White Sox now 5 games back in the Central with Cleveland in between them. And as far as in the wild card, the White Sox are 3.5 games back of the third wild card, now with 3 teams in between them. Baltimore has jumped ahead of the White Sox. Seattle, Cleveland, and Baltimore ahead of the White Sox.
The Orioles have won 7 straight games.
They've won 7 straight games. The Orioles' starting pitchers have the best ERA as a rotation in baseball since the middle of June.
What is his team, man?
Since Adley Rutschman came up, the Orioles are 6 games over 500 since he came up in the middle of May. They have a bunch of big arms on that staff and a bunch of impressive 5-tool or at least 2-way players, guys who can play defense and offense, and they're doing good things. But anyway, if you're the White Sox, I know it feels bleak, and it is bleak, but you can't make up your mind right now to become a seller just yet. No, and I don't think they're going to do it in general. I'd be very, very surprised if they do it. But if there's a real bad stretch here in terms of wins and losses, and it helps define you and give you some clarity by the end of the month, then you do need to pivot and take the opportunity. It's just, I don't think they're going to play that poorly. They're not going to lose that many games to make it that obvious. It's Matt Spiegel here with you on Hit and Run. Jim Callis from MLB Pipeline. Tell us about the Cubs prospects that matter. Tell us about the White Sox prospects that matter. Who can we expect soon? And explain to me what Matt Mervis is and if he's real and what we're actually looking at. We'll do that next with Jim Callis right here on 670 The Score.
The premier baseball show in Chicago. Hit and Run with Matt Spiegel.
Cubs set and delivers. The 1-1 pitch is launched. Deep out towards right field. Goodbye. The Cubs win it. A walk-off grand slam with 2 outs in the ninth. The 19-year-old, 2 hours away from his birthday, sends the Cubs home with an 8-6 victory.
Owen Casey, 19 years old. He's gotten a lot done already in his minor league career. Will the Darvish trade age better than it felt at the time? And frankly, it still feels now in light of kind of pushing the Cubs towards a build, if not a full-on rebuild, however you want to semantically call that. If Owen Casey ends up being an effective and useful part of a bunch of good teams, that trade will age a little better, but we might be a long way from it. Let's figure out exactly what we have in the systems for the Cubs and the Sox right now. It's been a long time since we talked to Jim Callis of MLB Pipeline. Jim joins us on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline. Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. And when I say us, I mean me, Matt Spiegel. Hello, Jim. How are you? Hope all is well.
Yeah, I'm doing well, Matt. How are you?
Great. So as we've asked Cub fans to zoom out, and I know the draft looms, and want to talk to you a little bit about that, but a nice opportunity here to ask you about some of the prospects in the system. What do you think of Owen Casey, and how aggressive should the Cubs be in sort of pushing him along and seeing what he can do?
You know, I think they've actually been kind of aggressive. I mean, if you look at the guys they got in the Darvish trade, he's been, you know, he was the one they pushed from rookie ball to low A last year. And then even though he didn't tear up low A and he just played, I think it was what, like about a month there, they promoted him to high A this year. He's still only 20. I don't have a problem with keeping him in high A, even if it winds up being the whole season. I mean, I like Owen Casey a lot. You know, super interesting. I mean, with the bat speed and the strength and leverage, there's a lot of power there. But it's not like, you know, he's having a good season, but he's striking out three times as much as he's walking in high A at age 20. I would just kind of let him sit there and develop for right now.
So overall, it feels like they have been aggressive with a lot of those prospects that they gained in the trades. What do you think about the way that they're moving some of these guys through the system? Is this a harbinger of how quickly they want some guys to get to the big leagues? That's an easy way to read it.
I think Casey's been more the exception. I honestly think they've let the guys kind of let the development take care of themselves. I mean, you know, we've seen Caleb Killian in the big leagues, and you know, the weird thing is he was the exact opposite in the big leagues of what you saw throughout his minor league career, where he throws a ton of strikes. Like he just was not that guy in his first three big league starts. But, you know, I mean, he was playing very well in AAA. So I think it was more a case of, you know, like not so much pushing him as him being ready. And, you know, Pete Crow Armstrong came over in the Javi Baez trade, was just destroying low A. You know, he barely played coming into this year because of the pandemic, and then he was hurt last year, and they moved him up. So I haven't necessarily felt, Matt, that they're trying to push guys aggressively. It's been more than, I think, when you have a young guy like a Casey or a Pete Crow Armstrong, or you have an older guy like a Caleb Killian, whose performance merits it, they've moved those guys. But I haven't really sensed that they're trying to push the guys up to try to get them to Chicago quicker.
Okay. Well, you know, I sensed a bunch and heard, talked to people about some aggressive placements at the beginning of the year. But no, I appreciate your correction on it in terms of like how they're moving him through. Do you have any impressions of the Cubs as a development system now in the post Jason McLeod era? Like, what has changed from the way that Theo used to do it to the way that now Jed is doing it at this point?
Well, I mean, not a lot of specifics, because I think they do try to keep some stuff under wraps. But I mean, I don't think it's any secret. And look, I mean, Jed will tell you. I mean, he was part of that Theo Jason team too, so it wasn't like Jed was in the corner going, "Wait, we're doing this wrong. We got to change things." But like, I mean, I think even Jason would tell you, and Theo would tell you, they didn't do a very good job of developing pitching while those guys were there. And I think they've overhauled what they've looked for. You know, I do think they went through a couple years where they were prioritizing guys with clean deliveries, who threw strikes, who had success in Power Five conferences. And look, Keegan Thompson's pitching well in the big leagues right now, but they drafted a bunch of the same guy. And a lot of times when you have guys with clean deliveries who throw strikes, I mean, I'm oversimplifying this a little bit, but the hitters see the ball out of their hand really well. And you know, it wasn't guys who had, you know, were throwing mid-90s. It was more low 90s. And a lot of the Corey Abbotts and Tyler Millers and those guys got hit when they got the chance to pitch at the upper levels. So I think they've kind of changed that. And I mean, we've all heard about the pitching lab. I don't think we get a lot of particulars about what they're doing, but I mean, I think they're one of these teams that's trying to add, you know, the sweeping slider, you know, as an integral pitch. And, you know, it seems like everybody's all about now, you know, instead of two seam sink, it's four seamers up with carry and, mm-hmm. you know, induced vertical break and that type of thing. So I think they've kind of, without, again, they aren't telling us exactly what they're doing, but I think they're taking a broader look at the type of pitchers they're trying to bring into the organization, not just a lot of the same necessarily type guy. And I think they're trying new ways to develop them.
Jim Callis with MLB Pipeline, what do you think of Matt Mervis at age 24, a 39th round draft pick of the Nationals in 2016? So this is a guy who was, you know, more than...
Well, that was out of high school. That was out of high school, and he was going to Duke. So, like, he wasn't going to sign.
Okay.
He was drafted out of a prep school, and he was going to Duke. So Matt Mervis was not going to sign for $125,000. So his high school draft status, I don't think, is super fair. And, you know, he was one of the... At the time, we thought he was one of the better guys in the pandemic when they only had a five-round draft. He didn't get drafted, and he signed. You know, they had a $20,000 limit you could sign non-drafted players for that year, and he was one of the better players to sign, and it made sense. I mean, he was a fourth-year guy; he was 22. You know, he's a prospect. I mean, I caution maybe about getting like super excited, like, oh, this guy's can't miss because he's got 1,000 ops and 20 home runs already, because, you know, he's not super young. As you point out, he's 24. You know, the thing that I think that's positive is, you know, I mean, when he tore up high A, he should have torn up high A. You know, everybody's development path got kind of slowed because of the pandemic, and he was no exception. He didn't have a very good year in low A last year, but he's continuing to mash in double A. Now, I think the key for him is going to be probably, you know, proving that he can have this kind of success in AAA in the big leagues. He's an aggressive hitter. He doesn't walk much. He doesn't strike out like a horrible amount, but he doesn't walk. And like sometimes those guys, when you get to AAA, you get to the big leagues, those pitchers make you expand your zone a little bit. You know, it's a little bit of a tough profile because he's dabbled a little bit. You know, I think he played a game at third, a game in the outfield last year, but he's a first baseman only. And obviously the bar is pretty high there, but you know, I think he's been one of the more pleasant developments in the system this year. And, you know, I don't know that they would necessarily promote him to AAA this year. I haven't looked kind of at the organization depth chart, but like if he keeps hitting double A, they probably do need to get him into Iowa and start thinking about, you know, at some point next year, getting him to Chicago and seeing what he could do.
Is there a sense, or am I just seeing it more, that double A is the new AAA in terms of promotion? Like I'm seeing some people, whether it's Michael Harris down in Atlanta, or, you know, others like just skipping AAA. Why is that happening a little more often this year, or is it just my sensation?
I don't know. I'm going to be the naysayer here again, Matt. Like, I swear we were talking about this when I started working at Baseball America in the late 80s and early 90s about how more guys were getting promoted from double A. You know what it is? I think when you notice it, it's a lot of times it's contenders. You know, like the Braves are trying to win now, and Michael Harris is a top 100 prospect who was playing well. They had a need in the outfield. And it's like, look, let's go get this guy. You know, I don't think like, and I'm not trying to say that Matt Mervis is in the same, you know, boat as Michael Harris, but like, you know, the Cubs aren't, you know, in a position where they're trying to, I mean, you're trying to win, you know what I'm saying? They're not contending this year. They're not going to go to the playoffs. So like, if they have, I'm just trying to find an example of a guy, like a guy who's in double A.
Well, I mean, well, like a cut.
Like Ryan Jensen or Alexander Canario.
Sure.
Like neither one who's lighting it up. But like, even if they were, I think you'd see the Cubs say, okay, let's move them to AAA and see what they do. And they do that with Caleb Killian. You know, Caleb Killian dominated AA. Like he tore up the fall league. You perhaps made a case, hey, let's put him straight in the big league. I mean, it wouldn't really make sense. Instead, it was like, no, let's put him in AAA for a while and see what he can do. So I think a lot of it depends on, I think you see it more with the more elite type prospect. And then if the team's trying to win now, it's like, look, this guy's really good and he's our best player. Let's get him up here.
Yeah, we just have time for one or two more moments where Jim Callis shoots down all my harebrained fears.
I know, I'm not being a very good guest.
I don't think I'm being a very good host, frankly, Jim. It's on me. Don't take it personally. Colson Montgomery, where do you see as Colson Montgomery's ceiling? This is a guy that White Sox fans hear a lot about but haven't had a chance to see yet, really.
Yeah, no, he's exciting. I mean, it's kind of like, I almost feel like it's a lazy comp, although I keep using it because everybody does too. Like, yeah, you know, he's a 6'4", left-handed hitting, you know, shortstop with a chance to stay there. And so everybody kind of comps him to Corey Seager. And, you know, I think what's been really good about his development is, you know, a lot of times guys come into pro ball, and you saw this with their second round pick last year, Wes Cat. They come into pro ball and they're a high pick and they got a 7-figure bonus and they try to do too much. And Colson Montgomery is just kind of taking things as they come. You know, he did not hit a home run in his debut last year, but he controlled the strike zone. He hit .287 in rookie ball. And kind of the same thing this year. Like, he didn't hit a lot of home runs early. He still only has 6. But he's hitting .327. He's controlling the strike zone. And I think he's been more worried about getting acclimated to pro pitching. And you know, it's easy to say this, and a lot of guys just don't take it to heart. But, I mean, you're talking about a 6'4" guy, 205 pounds. He's going to get, you know, even stronger. He's making good swing decisions. He's making contact. He's got bat speed. I mean, this guy's going to be a 20-25 home run guy without swinging for the fences. And he's come in and he's handled pro ball really well. So I liked him when they drafted him, and he's been, I'd have to say, I think even better than I thought he was going to be, at least, you know, initially.
So Jim, if I tune into the Futures game, which I love to do, and at MLB Network, I get Scott Braun, Yonder Alonso, and Jim Callis will be there on the call. And I'll see Oscar Colas, and I'll see Pete Crow Armstrong. Who are you excited to get a look at up close and personal in that Futures game?
I'm excited about seeing both those guys. I did get to see Pete Crow Armstrong. I mean, it was a couple of years ago at the Under Armour game when that was at Wrigley. I think the guy I'm most excited about seeing is Yuri Perez of the Marlins. He's this 19-year-old kid who's just, you know, because of the pandemic, he didn't make his pro debut until last year. He's 6'8". He tore up, like, low A and high A at 18. He's tearing up double A at age 19. And he's just, it's uncanny how advanced this guy is. Usually when you have a guy who's that big and that young, they're trying to figure things out and keep everything in sync. And he's got 3+ pitches and can really, it would probably be him. I did get to see Oscar in spring training on the backfields, and he looked pretty good when I saw him there too.
So Jim, 31 of the 50 players on the Future Games rosters are in your top 100 prospects list at MLB Pipeline. Just absolutely stacked. And you enjoy doing that game? You enjoy getting to do it?
I do. Yeah, no, it's a lot of fun. I mean, I wish they won't listen to me. I hate that it's 7 innings. I wish it was 9 innings. You aren't going to see, I can't think of any other event during the year where you're going to see that many of baseball's best prospects on the field at the same time. I mean, like, there's some cool games in the fall league and the fall stars game, but it's not the same, especially from the pitching side. I mean, literally every guy they bring out, and it's kind of cool because it's only one inning. So these guys aren't trying to go six. They're coming out and you know, giving you everything they have for a full inning, and you're going to see a lot of really good arms. It's just a lot of fun seeing the best against the best.
Jim, thanks so much. Have a great week. Appreciate it.
Yeah, great talking to you, Matt. Take care.
You too. That's Jim Callis from MLB Pipeline. Ron Coomer at the top of the hour. Carter Hawkins is the GM of the Cubs. You know that, but I don't know how often you've heard him speak. Good interview with Lawrence Holmes and Mark Grody. Want to play some of that for you and give you my thoughts on it. We'll do that next on The Score.
The premier baseball show in Chicago, Hit and Run with Matt Spiegel.
An hour from now, the great Chris Kamka is going to join us, as he always does. Ron Coomer at the top of the hour, but wanted you to hear from Carter Hawkins, the Cubs GM, who was on The Score this week with Lawrence Holmes and Mark Grody.
Carter, when you're talking about a player making it to the major leagues, like, just making it to the show doesn't end their development. So how do you, as an organization, what's the philosophy on continuing to develop a major league player?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think back to, you know, my time in Cleveland, and I think about watching, you know, Corey Kluber's first outing in the major leagues. It was pretty bad. You know, I think, you know, he hit a guy in the head, you know, one of those first pitches, and everybody's looking around like, who is this guy? But at the same time, you know, that development path isn't linear, and it certainly doesn't stop when you get to the major leagues. Now, getting to the major leagues puts an extra barrier in place because, you know, one, everything you're doing is in front of tens of thousands of fans, you know, in person, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people watching on TV. So it adds that extra layer of pressure. It makes it a little bit more difficult to try things. But at the same time, I think you're seeing around the league players that have gotten to the major league level, made adjustments, and really just changed the trajectory of their careers or continue the development of their careers. And I think it's really just having that extra partnership with the player, making sure that when we're suggesting things to them, that there's a lot of evidence behind it, and the player is helping to drive that process. And when you get that trust on both sides, you can get guys to really buy into things, and you see some of the things that you see, like, you know, Adrian Sampson, you know, and what he's been able to do over the last, you know, few starts. He's made some changes at the major league level and, you know, has really shown some success as a result of it.
Christopher Morel, interesting guy. I mean, he sort of caught me off guard as a guy that you guys would elevate to the bigs, let alone thrive in the bigs at this point. Honestly, are you surprised that you have gotten what you guys have gotten out of Christopher Morel?
Yeah, absolutely. I think anybody that they would say, oh, yeah, I knew that he was going to come up and have an 850 OPS and, like, and be the, you know, be the backbone of our energy and everything on the team. Like, of course we didn't know that. Of course, we thought we had the potential to, but that's just so much fun about this, is we have no idea how good these guys can be. But at the same time, that doesn't mean we throw up our hands and say, hey, we're just going to let's see where the chips fall. We can say, okay, how can we make each of these guys better? What resources can we put in place? What plans can we put in place to make sure that we are optimizing our chance for these guys to have that 90th percentile outcome like Chris has had over the last few weeks? So, yeah, surprise for sure. Excited. They're looking for ways to continue to have him progress. You know, I think you're seeing him make some adjustments at the major league level. I mean, it doesn't take, you know, a super scout to realize that he's getting a lot of breaking balls now. Like, okay, like, how's he going to adjust to that? And, you know, he's done a really good job of it. Obviously got into one last night. And, yeah, just a really exciting aspect of the development process for him and for the entire organization.
Carter Hawkins, the general manager of the Chicago Cubs, joining us here for a few minutes on The Score. I'm fascinated by Keegan Thompson. I think that you could look at him like trajectory wise and go, that's a guy who's in the middle of a rotation or maybe the top of a rotation, or this is a high leverage reliever at the end of games. Have you guys made a decision on what you think he is, or are both of those options still on the table?
I'd say both options are always on the table. But at the same time, it's like, we want the guys that throw the best having the chance to get the most outs, and the best way to do that is in a starter's role. And Keegan has certainly shown us that he can do that in a starter's role. Now, you know, if we could always optimize or, you know, just find the highest leverage 5 or 6 innings for someone to throw, we would do that, but it's really difficult to make that prediction, you know, day in and day out and not have a guy sit on the bench for 10 days. So that's, I think, why starters get on the routines that they get on. But I mean, heck, this guy obviously, you know, has come out, you know, had some really big games for us, some games that have stopped some skids for us, which is really hard to do. He's getting strikeouts, he's throwing strikes, he's logging innings. It's a really impressive progression for him that, you know, speaks to the things that the organization put in place, you know, well before I got here. So we couldn't be more excited about Keegan and the things he's doing. And, you know, whatever role it is, it's going to be a high leverage one for us. And, you know, really excited that he's on our team.
Carter, with the present state of the organization, we're all back at a point where, as those of us in the media and plenty of Cubs fans, we are again paying attention to what is going on with the minor leagues and those potential major league prospects, especially the ones that I look at are the ones that you guys were able to get for Chris Bryant and Javier Baez and Anthony Rizzo. And one of those guys was in the Baez deal, who has had a strong year, sort of a revealing year this year, is Pete Crow Armstrong, PCA, who is going to be playing in the Futures game. I don't want to rush any processes, but when you look at a guy like that, how close to being ready is he, and how far off might he be? Because we hear a lot about him.
Yeah, I mean, I think any of our players that, you know, have the skills that a guy like PCA has, you know, could go up and play in the major leagues and be able to have some success. I think specifically for Pete, you know, his defense is something that's, you know, major league caliber. I mean, you see it in spring training when these guys come up and play major league games. It's not like they look out of place. You know, really what we're looking to try to develop in a lot of ways is just the consistency of that greatness. You know, great is just good, consistent over time, oftentimes. And Pete, you know, certainly has shown that on defense and continuing to try to, you know, develop his approach offensively. Tore the cover off the ball in Myrtle Beach, added some power. You know, he really hasn't had that much bulk in his professional career just because of some injuries early on in his career. But, you know, now that he's healthy, we've been able to see, you know, the things that he can do at the plate. So saw it in Myrtle and have continued to see it at South Bend. He's in high A right now. You know, to your point, like, can't really put a timeline on it, mm-hmm. but he's certainly moving fast, and a guy that, you know, everybody organizationally is excited about. And I think, you know, with his Futures game nomination, somebody that the industry is definitely taking a look at pretty hard.
I'm sure that there are teams that are kind of in their championship windows that are looking at your roster and kind of licking their chops. When it comes to the players on your team that there have been rumors about maybe trading, what's the organizational philosophy on how to deal with that with the player? And what I mean, Carter, is are you in constant contact with players, or have you told them, look, there's nothing that's happened. If something happens, we are going to let you know before a deal gets done?
Yeah, I think you try to be as respectful as possible, especially with guys that, you know, have been around the game for a long time or have been in the organization a long time, with just communicating anything, you know, whether that's a roster move, whether that's, you know, just a change in where they're going to hit in the lineup, whether that's a change in what their role is going to be. And, you know, I think that the trade process is no different. You know, so there's nothing that we've done, you know, proactively at this point. But I think if we got to that point with any of our players, to the extent that we're able to treat that with as much respect as possible. I mean, I think about it like, you know, from a standpoint of just a personal life, right? Like you're up and moving. I mean, I guess we could all imagine if our bosses came in and said, hey, you know, I need you to move to Kansas City tomorrow. You'd be like, well, what the heck? Like all the things that you have to figure out for your life. So anything we can do on that end, just to be a place where players want to play and feel like they're communicated with, we're going to do. You know, I don't think that that's any different than, or I think that certainly applies to the trade process as well.
Is it hard to... this is going to sound weird, me even asking it this way, to know that you're dealing with human beings instead of just the numbers. And is that a hard thing for an executive to learn, that it isn't just trading cards or picking up trading cards, that you are dealing with actual human beings?
I think it's something that you learn over time. And as you spend more time down in the clubhouse, as you spend more time at a minor league affiliate, you spend more time, you know, in the locker room of a minor league coaching staff or with scouts out on the road, it can be really easy to think about players just as names on a spreadsheet. Then you think about, you know, you move a player's name on a spreadsheet from column A to column B, and that's a 17-year-old Latin American kid that now is getting to go to the States for the first time because you moved him from column A to column B. And then you think about the cascading effects of that decision. And now his family's so excited that he's going to the States and he's probably having a party and, you know, all of these different emotions and the things that he'd worked so hard towards. And I think there's value, you know, certainly in understanding that, not letting it get in the way of good decisions, but letting it be something that helps you connect at a better level across the organization so that you get buy-in on the things that you're trying to do with your coaches, with your staff, with your scouts, and with your players. So, yeah, it's hard, and it definitely on the not fun conversations makes it really hard. And I think my wife could tell you that, you know, when we have some of those not fun conversations, I'm definitely in a much different mood. So that's not the fun part of the job by any means. Luckily it's 1% of it, not 99.
That's where the cats come in handy because they're very soothing.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's,
if you maybe change the litter box on a day we had to have a really difficult conversation, not sure I could come back from that.
Hey, I bet I know when you are in a good mood because, you know, you were a scout, you were a player development guy, director of it in Cleveland. Hey, man, you guys have the number 7 overall pick in this year's draft coming up July 17th to the 19th. Is that the best time for a GM, a person in your position, whether with the Cubs or in your life with Cleveland?
It's definitely fun, but it's just so challenging as well. There's just so much variance around any of these picks. You know, even the guys that get picked first overall, you know, not all of those guys, you know, end up being elite players or you know, even average players. You think about Mark Appel, who was a 1-1 pick by the Astros years and years ago, just made his debut.
Yeah.
You know, he got drafted, you know, with Chris Bryant. So think about all that's transpired since Chris Bryant was drafted way back when. You know, Mark Appel's been grinding it through the minor league during that exact same time as the number one pick. So it's an area or a time of a lot of stress just because of all that variance and just trying to figure out how can I mitigate, you know, just the error bars around this decision. But also, it's really fun to dream and think about, you know, what we can do with players and how we can really get them into our system and help them, you know, be the players that we all hope they can become. So from that standpoint, it's really fun. And it's just fun to reconnect with some of the scouts that have been out on the road all year. You know, you just don't get to see those guys every day, and having them come back in, that's always a time to celebrate too.
You know, we'll see how this stuff manifests in the next few years in terms of what the Cubs do on the big league level. But having Carter Hawkins bring the Cleveland mindset of development and scouting, and especially how they think about pitching, and bring an outside perspective as opposed to, you know, another employee who learned under Theo and Jed in Boston and kind of furthers things like that. It's a very healthy thing for the organization. I find Carter Hawkins to be thoughtful and kind of impressive as a front office dude. We'll see what it manifests. But also, I think he's smooth as a talker, isn't he? He's very smooth, gives good, solid answers. And you kind of you understand what he's saying. The Pete Crow Armstrong stuff, the way that he talked about that, I really liked that. Like, oh, you could call a guy up and you can see he would look like a big leaguer. We're just trying to get it to be more consistent. We want it to be more consistent that he looks that way. So I found that to be interesting stuff. It was Carter Hawkins with Holmes and Grody during the week. It is Matt Spiegel here with you on Hit and Run. Lots to come, starting with Ron Coomer in a matter of moments right here on The Score.
Joe in Chicago, Hit and Run with Matt Spiegel.
An hour from now, the great Chris Kamka is going to join us, as he always does. Ron Coomer at the top of the hour, but wanted you to hear from Carter Hawkins, the Cubs GM, who was on The Score this week with Lawrence Holmes and Mark Grody.
Carter, when you're talking about a player making it to the major leagues, like just making it to the show doesn't end their development. So how do you as an organization, what's the philosophy on continuing to develop a major league player?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think back to, you know, my time in Cleveland, and I think about watching, you know, Corey Kluber's first outing in the major leagues. It was pretty bad. You know, I think, you know, he hit a guy in the head, you know, one of those first pitches, and everybody's looking around like, who is this guy? But at the same time, you know, that development path isn't linear, and it certainly doesn't stop when you get to the major leagues. Now, getting to the major leagues puts an extra barrier in place because, you know, one, everything you're doing is in front of tens of thousands of fans, you know, in person, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people watching on TV. So it adds that extra layer of pressure. It makes it a little bit more difficult to try things. But at the same time, I think you're seeing around the league players that have gotten to the major league level, made adjustments, and really just changed the trajectory of their careers or continue the development of their careers. And I think it's really just having that extra partnership with the player, making sure that when we're suggesting things to them, that there's a lot of evidence behind it. And the player is helping to drive that process. And when you get that trust on both sides, you can get guys to really buy into things. And you see some of the things that you see, like, you know, Adrian Sampson, you know, and what he's been able to do over the last, you know, few starts. He's made some changes at the major league level and, you know, has really shown some success as a result of it.
Christopher Morel, interesting guy. I mean, he sort of caught me off guard as a guy that you guys would elevate to the bigs, let alone thrive in the bigs at this point. Honestly, are you surprised that you have gotten what you guys have gotten out of Christopher Morel?
Yeah, absolutely. I think anybody that they would say, oh yeah, I knew that he was going to come up and have an 850 OPS and, like, and be the, you know, be the backbone of our energy and everything on the team. Like, of course we didn't know that. Of course we thought we had the potential to, but that's just so much fun about this is we have no idea how good these guys can be. But at the same time, that doesn't mean we throw up our hands and say, hey, we're just going to let's see where the chips fall. We can say, okay, how can we make each of these guys better? What resources can we put in place? What plans can we put in place to make sure that we are optimizing our chance for these guys to have that 90th percentile outcome like Chris has had over the last few weeks? So, yeah, surprise for sure. Excited. You know, looking for ways to continue to have him progress. You know, I think you're seeing him make some adjustments at the major league level. I mean, it doesn't take, you know, a super scout to realize that he's getting a lot of breaking balls now. Like, okay, like, how's he going to adjust to that? And, you know, he's done a really good job of it. Obviously got into one last night. And, yeah, just a really exciting aspect of the development process for him and for the entire organization.
Carter Hawkins, the general manager of the Chicago Cubs, joining us here for a few minutes on The Score. I'm fascinated by Keegan Thompson. I think that you could look at him like trajectory wise and go, that's a guy who's in the middle of a rotation or maybe the top of a rotation, or this is a high leverage reliever at the end of games. Have you guys made a decision on what you think he is, or are both of those options still on the table?
I'd say both options are always on the table. But at the same time, it's like, we want the guys that throw the best having the chance to get the most outs, and the best way to do that is in a starter's role. And Keegan has certainly shown us that he can do that in a starter's role. Now, you know, if we could always optimize or, you know, just find the highest leverage 5 or 6 innings for someone to throw, we would do that, but it's really difficult to make that prediction, you know, day in and day out and not have a guy sit on the bench for 10 days. So that's, I think, why starters get on the routines that they get on. But I mean, heck, this guy obviously, you know, has come out, you know, had some really big games for us, some games that have stopped some skids for us, which is really hard to do. He's getting strikeouts. He's throwing strikes. He's logging innings. It's a really impressive progression for him that speaks to the things that the organization put in place, well before I got here. So we couldn't be more excited about Keegan and the things he's doing. And, whatever role it is, it's going to be a high leverage one for us. And, really excited that he's on our team.
Carter, with the present state of the organization, we're all back at a point where, as those of us in the media and plenty of Cubs fans, we are again paying attention to what is going on with the minor leagues and those potential major league prospects, especially the ones that I look at are the ones that you guys were able to get for Chris Bryant and Javier Baez and Anthony Rizzo. And one of those guys is what was in the Baez deal, who has had a strong year, sort of a revealing year this year, is Pete Crow Armstrong, PCA, who is going to be playing in the Futures game. I don't want to rush any processes, but when you look at a guy like that, how close to being ready is he and how far off might he be? Because we hear a lot about him.
Yeah, I mean, I think any of our players that, have the skills that a guy like PCA has, could go up and play in the major leagues and be able to have some success. I think specifically for Pete, his defense is something that's, major league caliber. I mean, you see it in spring training when these guys come up and play major league games. It's not like they look out of place. Really what we're looking to try to develop in a lot of ways is just the consistency of that greatness. Great is just good, consistent over time, oftentimes. And Pete, certainly has shown that on defense and continuing to try to, develop his approach offensively. Tore the cover off the ball in Myrtle Beach, added some power. He really hasn't had that much bulk in his professional career just because of some injuries early on in his career. But, now that he's healthy, we've been able to see, the things that he can do at the plate. So saw it in Myrtle and have continued to see it at South Bend. He's in high A right now. To your point, can't really put a timeline on it, but he's certainly moving fast and a guy that, everybody organizationally is excited about. And I think, with this Futures game nomination, somebody that the industry is definitely taking a look at pretty hard.
I'm sure that there are teams that are kind of in their championship windows that are looking at your roster and kind of licking their chops. When it comes to the players on your team that there have been rumors about maybe trading, what's the organizational philosophy on how to deal with that with the player? And what I mean, Carter, is are you in constant contact with players or have you told them, look, there's nothing that's happened. If something happens, we are going to let you know before a deal gets done?
Yeah, I think you try to be as respectful as possible, especially with guys that have been around the game for a long time or have been in the organization a long time with just communicating anything, whether that's a roster move, whether that's, just a change in where they're going to hit in the lineup, whether that's a change in what their role is going to be. And, I think that the trade process is no different. So there's nothing that we've done, proactively at this point. But I think if we got to that point with any of our players, to the extent that we're able to treat that with as much respect as possible. I mean, I think about it from a standpoint of just a personal life, right? You're up and moving. I mean, I guess we could all imagine if our bosses came in and said, hey, I need you to move to Kansas City tomorrow. You'd be like, well, what the heck? All the things that you have to figure out for your life. So anything we can do on that end, just to be a place where players want to play and feel like they're communicated with or going to do. I don't think that that's any different than, or I think that certainly applies to the trade process as well.
Is it hard to... this is going to sound weird, me even asking it this way, to know that you're dealing with human beings instead of just the numbers? And is that a hard thing for an executive to learn, that it isn't just trading cards or picking up trading cards, that you are dealing with actual human beings?
I think it is something that you learn over time. And as you spend more time down in the clubhouse, as you spend more time at a minor league affiliate, you spend more time in the locker room of a minor league coaching staff or with scouts out on the road, it can be really easy to think about players just as names on a spreadsheet. Then you think about, you move a player's name on a spreadsheet from column A to column B, and that's a 17-year-old Latin American kid that now is getting to go to the States for the first time because you moved him from column A to column B. And then you think about the cascading effects of that decision. And now his family's so excited that he's going to the States and he's probably having a party and, all of these different emotions and the things that he'd worked so hard towards. And I think there's value, certainly in understanding that, not letting it get in the way of good decisions, but letting it be something that helps you connect at a better level across the organization so that you get buy-in on the things that you're trying to do with your coaches, with your staff, with your scouts, and with your players. So, yeah, it's hard, and it definitely on the not fun conversations makes it really hard. And I think my wife could tell you that, you know, when we have some of those not fun conversations, I'm definitely in a much different mood. So that's not the fun part of the job by any means. Luckily, it's 1% of it, not 99%.
That's where the cats come in handy because they're very soothing.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's.
If you maybe change the litter box on a day we had to have a really difficult conversation, not sure I could come back from that.
Hey, I bet I know when you are in a good mood because, you know, you were a scout, you were a player development guy, director of it in Cleveland. Hey, man, you guys have the number 7 overall pick in this year's draft coming up July 17th to the 19th. Is that the best time for a GM, a person in your position, whether with the Cubs or in your life with Cleveland?
It's definitely fun, but it's just so challenging as well. There's just so much variance around any of these picks. You know, even the guys that get picked first overall, you know, not all of those guys, you know, end up being elite players or you know, even average players. You think about Mark Appel, who was a 1-1 pick by the Astros years and years ago, just made his debut.
Yeah.
You know, he got drafted, you know, with Chris Bryant. So think about all that's transpired since Chris Bryant was drafted way back when. You know, Mark Appel's been grinding it through the minor league during that exact same time as the number one pick. So it's an area or a time of a lot of stress just because of all that variance and just trying to figure out how can I mitigate, you know, just the error bars around this decision. But also, it's really fun to dream and think about, you know, what we can do with players and how we can really get them into our system and help them, you know, be the players that we all hope they can become. So from that standpoint, it's really fun. And it's just fun to reconnect with some of the scouts that have been out on the road all year. You know, you just don't get to see those guys every day, and having them come back in, that's always a time to celebrate too.
You know, we'll see how this stuff manifests in the next few years in terms of what the Cubs do on the big league level. But having Carter Hawkins bring the Cleveland mindset of development and scouting, and especially how they think about pitching, and bring an outside perspective as opposed to, you know, another employee who learned under Theo and Jed in Boston and kind of furthers things like that. It's a very healthy thing for the organization. I find Carter Hawkins to be thoughtful and kind of impressive as a front office dude. We'll see what it manifests. But also, I think he's smooth as a talker, isn't he? He's very smooth, gives good, solid answers. And you understand what he's saying. The Pete Crow Armstrong stuff, the way that he talked about that, I really liked that. Like, oh, you could call a guy up and you can see he would look like a big leaguer. We're just trying to get it to be more consistent. We want it to be more consistent that he looks that way. So I found that to be interesting stuff. It was Carter Hawkins with Holmes and Grody during the week. It is Matt Spiegel here with you on Hit and Run. Lots to come, starting with Ron Coomer in a matter of moments right here on The Score.